content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And we'll be reading from the edition dated April 8th, 2011. But first, let's begin our program this week with a couple of items that did not occur until after press time. Can Obama prevent a government shutdown? The president demands that lawmakers act like grown-ups and says he'll call meetings every day until a deal is reached. Can he really convince Republicans to budge? After weeks of trying to stay above the fray, President Obama publicly stepped into the standoff over the 2011 federal budget on Tuesday, chiding Congress over its inability to take care of last year's business, simply because of politics, and offering to broker daily talks until an agreement is reached. If Congress doesn't act by Friday, the government will shut down. At issue are how many billions to cut and controversial GOP attempts to defund groups like Planned Parenthood. Obama's used such daddy's home moments to get bickering lawmakers to cut deals before, says John Dickerson at Slate. Will it work this time? Obama can't overcome a Tea Party veto. The president is doing his best to broker a deal that can pass both the House and the Senate, says Jed Lewison in Daily Cause. But because House Speaker John Boehner is insisting that any budget win the support of 218 House Republicans, the number needed to pass a deal without the support of any House Democrats, he's basically given Tea Party Republicans veto power. He needs their votes to reach his magic number, and Tea Party Republicans want a government shutdown. If they didn't, we'd already have a budget deal. The president can stop a shutdown by siding with the GOP. Obama's fits of pique over the stalled budget talks won't change political reality, says Hugh Hewitt at his blog. Republicans shellacked him in November, and unless the president signs on to the GOP budget, Boehner will have to patiently explain to voters that Obama cares more about Planned Parenthood, taxpayer subsidy for NPR and PBS, the EPA's carbon regulations, and health care reform than he does about their convenience. This is all theatrics. Don't believe the hand-wringers on either side, says Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Neither Boehner nor Obama wants a shutdown, and Boehner has enough votes to keep the government going for a week if need be. Boehner just wants House freshmen to know he gave it his all, which he did. In the meantime, I sort of suspect that Obama and Boehner are assigning each other sound bites and deciding how close to the wire they want to play this. Our second item is entitled, Would Paul Ryan's Budget Abolish Medicare? The GOP's House Budget Committee chairman proposes a thorough and very controversial overhaul of government health programs. House Republicans on Tuesday unveiled a 2012 budget proposal promising $6.2 trillion in savings over the next decade through spending cuts and savings on government health plans for the elderly and the poor. Liberals are enraged over the plan, crafted by GOP budget guru Representative Paul Ryan, the Republican from Wisconsin, because they say it won't merely trim Medicare and Medicaid, but effectively destroy them. Is Ryan trying to save Medicare or kill it? The GOP wants to dismantle Medicare entirely. Ryan would essentially eliminate Medicare by privatizing and voucherizing it, says Paul Krugman at the New York Times. But that does nothing whatsoever to control costs. It just saves money by limiting the vouchers, so they won't keep up with rising health care costs, in other words, by denying medical care to those who can't afford to top up their premiums. No, the way to kill Medicare is leaving it alone. Medicare and Medicaid are unsustainable in their current form, says Douglas Holtz Eakin at the National Review. So the cruelest of options is to leave them alone and consign them to certain death. Ryan is proposing that we address the real problem, which is that Medicare is set up as an unaffordable entitlement program. By giving the elderly premium support instead, they'll be able to pay for and choose the level of coverage they need. Stopping this is Obama's big test. Now Americans know how high the stakes are in this budget fight, says E.J. Dionne Jr. in the Washington Post. This is class warfare. The Republicans are determined to slash taxes for the rich and end programs for the poor, which would turn back the clock to before the New Deal. The question is, will President Obama rise to the occasion and stand up for the vision of a practical progressive government that he once advanced so eloquently? And now we'll turn to the main story from our printed edition of the Week magazine for April 8, 2011, entitled Gaddafi's Offensive Has Rebels in Retreat. What happened? Hopes that Muammar al-Qaddafi's regime would quickly crumble suffered a major setback this past week as his loyalists drove rebel forces back dozens of miles under a hail of tank and rocket fire. Where is Sarkozy? The retreating rebel fighters asked. Just days earlier, they had raced westward toward Tripoli under cover of punishing airstrikes from U.S., French, and British warships and fighter jets. The rebels had been advancing on the Qaddafi stronghold of Sirte, his birthplace, when they were confronted by Libyan armor. Over the following days, Qaddafi's better trained and better equipped forces counterattacked, routing the ragtag band of rebels and driving them out of the strategically important oil towns of Ras Lanuf and Brega. The alarming string of setbacks came as NATO took control of the military operation in Libya amid sharp disagreement over how to end Qaddafi's 42-year regime. American missiles rained down on Qaddafi's elite brigade of Tripoli, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton hinted that cracks were appearing in his inner circle. "We have a lot of evidence that people around him are reaching out," she said. NATO members met to discuss options for bolstering the rebels, including the possibility of providing them with weapons. But President Obama's response was ambiguous. "I'm not ruling it out, but I'm also not ruling it in," he said. Now here's what the editorial said. "President Obama has successfully prevented the massacre of thousands of civilians," said the Washington Post, "but the war in Libya is far from over. It will end only when Qaddafi is forced from power. Unfortunately, the Obama administration appears to lack any coherent strategy to achieve that aim, other than hoping for a sudden coup." "Before it's too late, the Allies should arm the rebels," said the New York Times. "Yes, there are still questions over who these rebels are, but they have already stated that their goal is a constitutional democratic system that guarantees elections and human rights. Only by ousting Qaddafi," said the Wall Street Journal, "will show the Assads and the Ahmadinejads that the West is willing and able to act against tyrants who slaughter their own people and foment terrorism. That outcome will deliver a Middle East that is freer and less hostile to American purposes." Now here's what the columnist said. "In case you hadn't noticed, Obama isn't in charge of this intervention," said William Salatin in Slate.com. "France, the UK, and Italy led the charge to beat Qaddafi back because they fear having a wounded madman right on their doorstep. The Obama administration agreed to loan our military to Europe for the operation as payback for NATO's help in Iraq and Afghanistan." What that means in the end is that Obama has failed to get Congress's approval for this military action while submitting to the authority of an international coalition. "By being led instead of leading," said Gideon Rose in the Washington Post, "President Obama broke the first rule of military engagement. Know your goals before you enter a conflict. U.S. forces are now engaged in a battle with no clear vision of what successful and stable outcome might be. Worse still," said Byron York in the Washington Examiner, "it looks as though some of the rebels are Islamists who only recently returned from fighting U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq. According to a recent study, one-fifth of foreign fighters in Iraq come from Libya. A major source of those fighters was the rebel stronghold of Benghazi, where Gaddafi had to put down an Islamist insurgency in the mid-1990s. Welcome to the Middle East of 2011, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. It's a messy, dangerous place, fraught with moral and political ambiguities, involving autocrats we need but dislike and revolutionaries we support but distrust. Anyone who claims to know precisely what we should do in Libya or Syria and the rest of the region is a fool. Obama is carefully picking his way through a minefield, and I'm just praying that he's lucky. Now let's turn to the disaster in the Pacific, Japan's crisis, no end in sight. Tokyo Electric Power officials this week admitted that they were losing their battle to contain the radiation leaks at Japan's stricken Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station. Despite frantic efforts by harried technicians, highly radioactive water leaking out of damaged reactors was hampering repair work, and officials said the crisis could persist for months. Authorities found not only high levels of radiation in seawater near the plant, but also plutonium in surrounding soil. Evidence is strong that at least two reactors have experienced a partial meltdown and that one containment vessel is cracked. The damage poses a dilemma to plant officials and workers who are still struggling to keep reactors and spent fuel rods from overheating. By spraying, dropping, and pumping in tons of water, they've created a new contamination source that spreads radioactivity as it leaks out. In seawater about 1,000 feet from the plant, sensors detected 3,355 times the normal level of iodine-131, a concentration officials contended does not pose a significant threat. Many workers are nearing the cumulative radiation limits set by Japan's government and will have to be replaced. The Japanese are dousing the reactors with hoses as though fighting a fire that could be put out, said George Johnson in the New York Times. But the partially melted fuel rods cannot be permanently extinguished, and radiation is an insidious force whose terror lies in the abstraction. The earthquake and tsunami claimed a finite toll of about 10,000, but radiation claims victims who do not know they are. Here in Japan, hope has dimmed as the conversation shifts from seismic activity to radioactivity, said J.T. Cassidy in the Baltimore Sun. My neighbors could handle shortages and power outages, but now we learn that the government has no laws on the books regulating safe radiation levels in food. Ordinary Japanese can only look on in apprehension as foreigners flee their country. Perhaps this crisis will finally compel Japan to shed its unquestioning faith in science and technology, said Janice Momura in Newsday. For generations, the nation's leaders have fostered this naive faith as the ideal way to address problems, given the Japanese people a false sense of security. Now that trust in technology is ebbing, as is public confidence in a government that's shown its inability to provide strong leadership in this unfolding disaster. Now it's Syria's turn. The wave of popular revolts rocking the Arab world has rolled into Syria, which this past week saw pro-democracy protests flare up across the country. Thousands of people took to the streets of cities and towns from Latakia in the northwest to Daraa in the south and called on President Bashar al-Assad to repeal 48-year-old laws that ban opposition parties and grant sweeping powers to security forces. Assad responded with a brutal crackdown. More than 60 protesters were killed during clashes with police, who broke up marches with bullets, batons, and tear gas. Assad did fire his cabinet and acknowledged that reform was needed, but said chaos would not be tolerated. Protesters, he said, were dupes of conspirators working for an Israeli agenda. The collapse of this murderous regime can't come soon enough, said Elliot Abrams in the Washington Post. Assad claimed to be a modernizer when he inherited power in 2000, but he has proved every bit as bloodthirsty as his late father, Hafez. He has turned to Syria into a pathway of jihadists from around the world to enter Iraq and kill U.S. troops. In neighboring Lebanon, Assad has ordered the car bomb killings of journalists and politicians who criticize him, and he continues to arm the militant group Hezbollah. It's clear that the Syrian tyrant is an enemy of the United States, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. So why isn't the Obama administration pushing the UN and the Arab League to take as strong a stand against Assad as they did against Libyan despot Muammar al-Qaddafi? Beware of what you wish for, said Patrick Seale in Foreign Policy. Syria is a volatile mixture of Sunni Muslims, Alawis, a Shia offshoot to which the president and his military chiefs belong, and Christians. If Assad's authoritarian government fell, the majority Sunnis would try to wrest power from the Alawis. And once the bloodthirsty sectarian demons have been unleashed in Syria, the entire region could be consumed in an orgy of violence. And the controversy of the week relates to the difficulties in the Mideast. It's entitled, Libya, the Obama Doctrine Comes into Focus. Finally, our cautious, pragmatic president has laid out his big ideas about the use of American power abroad, said Stephen Metz in the New Republic Online. In a speech on Libya on national television this week, President Obama explained why he sent in U.S. military forces only when the U.N. and Western allies agreed to help restrain Muammar al-Qaddafi's attacks on rebels. Even in crises such as Libya's, when our safety is not directly threatened, Obama said the world's only superpower has a responsibility to act in defense of innocent civilians, such as those likely to have been massacred in the city of Benghazi. But he rejected calls for the U.S. to take a more active role in Libya and other Middle Eastern revolutions, arguing that if we try to seize control of the Arab Spring, we could wind up mired in another Iraq war or provoke a bitter backlash against America. Qualifications aside, said William Crystal in the weeklystandard.com, the Obama Doctrine was an unapologetic freedom agenda embracing commitment to use our military might as a force for good in the world. That's wishful hearing, said Michael Hirsch in nationaljournal.com. Sure, Obama gave us a perfectly cogent argument for our intervention in Libya, but this was hardly the kind of grand foreign policy vision for which the term doctrine is usually reserved. We have a duty to prevent the slaughter of civilians, Obama said, but only when it's practical to do so. The U.S. reserves the right to act unilaterally, but feels more comfortable in a coalition. At one point, Obama even offered the lawyerly caveat that the grand principles he was espousing applied only to this particular country, Libya, at this particular moment. In other words, the real Obama doctrine is to have no doctrine at all. Obama vowed that on his watch, America would fight tyranny and defend the weak, said John Dickerson in Slate.com. But don't forget to read the fine print. Offer valid only if it's a relatively easy military mission and we have a lot of allies. Clearly, Obama hasn't forgotten his long-standing opposition to the Iraq War, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. Events in the Middle East, however, have forced him to fine-tune his aversion to U.S. military intervention. In Obama's formulation, the U.S. will no longer act as the world's policeman, but more in the role of a police chief, directing and coordinating joint action. It's just as we conservatives suspected, said Stanley Kurtz in NationalReview.com. At the core of this internationalist foreign policy thinking is a progressive vision of UN-dictated rights regime, in which the United States surrenders its authority to a global collective. What you neocons won't admit, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, is that the U.S. is not as powerful as it once was. We've learned the hard way in Iraq and Afghanistan that America's military might can't magically transform backward autocracies into friendly democracies. Thank goodness we have a president who understands that Libya is a wreck and we have no idea what happens if Qaddafi falls. The same is true of Egypt, Bahrain, Syria, and the rest of the Mideast. Each uprising is unique and full of peril. Carving firm guidelines in stone would probably be not only impossible, but dangerous. After the good versus evil binary logic of the Bush years, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post, Obama's nuanced case-by-case approach to foreign policy can seem maddeningly subtle at times, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. And now let's turn to the lighter side of the news from the Week magazine. It's time for a very popular article entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Well, it was a good week for starting your own Navy after the UK Ministry of Defense announced it would take bids on a decommissioned aircraft carrier, the HMS Ark Royal. Bidders have to outline their intentions regarding the vessel, the ministry said. It was a good week for Fred Mack of Newton Square, Pennsylvania, who celebrated his 100th birthday by skydiving, fulfilling a promise he made to himself when he first skydived on his 95th birthday. After landing, Mack said, "I'm still alive." And it was a good week for Texas Justice after a prosecutor there offered to let Willie Nelson pay a small fine to settle marijuana possession charges if he agreed to sing Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain in court. "I ain't going to be mean to Willie Nelson," said prosecutor Kit Bramblett. And it was a bad week for air traffic control after two jetliners were forced to land without guidance at Reagan National Airport in Arlington, Virginia, because the lone controller on duty after midnight had dozed off. It was a bad week for revisionist astrobiology after Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez suggested that Mars once had an advanced civilization that was wiped out by predatory capitalists. Maybe capitalism arrived there, imperialism arrived, and finished off the planet, Chavez said. And it was a bad week for overreach after a federal judge rejected the music industry's demand for $75 trillion from the firm LimeWire for enabling people to download songs for free. Judge Kemba Wood noted that $75 trillion was more money than the entire music industry has made since Edison's invention of the photograph in 1877. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for Friday, April 8th, 2011. Thanks for listening. Now let's turn to the section entitled People, Stern's Driving Insecurities. Howard Stern is a great big tangled ball of neuroses, said Neil Strauss in Rolling Stone magazine. The shock jock, who is 57 years old, said he owes his massive success to his obsessive need to please his mother. "The ability to interview people and read my subject comes from my mother being very demanding of me with one thing, that I should be able to read her mood and know what she wanted. I could look into my mother's eyes and know everything, when she was sad, when she was angry." That relationship, he says, left him with a deeply neurotic need to please his audience. "There is a side of me that needs this connection desperately and needs this acclaim and needs millions of people listening to me. Success and praise just make it worse. My OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, kicks in and my neuroses and I go, oh my God, these people think I'm so good and I'm going to have to get on the air Monday and I'm going to be able to do that. Am I going to be able to do that again for them on Monday? And they're going to hate me." Away from an audience, he's withdrawn and guarded. "I barely know how to socialize," he says. "I have a hard time having a conversation with anybody. I definitely want to connect, but I don't want to connect fully. I can only get so messy with people. And that about Howard Stern. The next article, The Wrestler Who Overcame His Disadvantage. Anthony Robles is an unlikely wrestling champion, said Liza Hamm in People. The Arizona State University senior won the NCAA wrestling championship for his weight class this season after going 36-0. And Robles did it with only one leg. Born without his right leg, Robles first started wrestling as a 90-pound high school freshman and against great odds. Despite his disability, he was very athletic and very determined, and he believed that wrestling suited what he could do. It was the one sport I could find a style that worked for me. Still, he lost practically every match his first 2 years, while he developed strength and skill. He starts matches on one knee, using his extraordinary balance and upper body strength to keep from being taken down by opponents. As he got stronger and better, he eventually rose to the state championship and now to a national collegiate title. "I put a lot of pressure on myself to win this," said Robles. "I'm so relieved and proud." Though there's been talk of trying out for the Olympic team, Robles says he's proved his point and is moving on from wrestling. "I had a great run," he says. "I got so much self-confidence from the sport." And our next item from People is Faye's moment of terror. When disaster strikes, Tina Fey is no hero, she tells The New Yorker. She discovered this shameful fact during the anthrax postal attacks in October 2011 when she was a writer for Saturday Night Live. "I was sitting in my tiny dressing room at Rockefeller Plaza looking for something funny to say about Afghanistan, the Taliban, Saddam Hussein. It was grim. Then she saw a bulletin on TV, 'Anthrax has been found at Rockefeller Plaza. CDC officials are investigating a suspicious package addressed to Tom Brokaw.' Her first instinct was to flee the NBC building as quickly as possible. I put on my coat, walking downstairs past my friends and co-workers without saying anything. I walked right past the host for that week, sweet Drew Barrymore, without telling her what I heard. Then I walked home and waited to die." Hours later, her boss, Lauren Michaels, tracked her down. Lauren called her and said gently, "We're all here. You and Drew are the only ones who left. And Drew came back a few hours ago. We're ordering dinner if you want to come back in." It was the kindest way of saying, "You are embarrassing yourself." Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the popular section entitled Briefing. And this week, the specific article is on the subject of black swans. From 9/11 to Japan's earthquake, history is shaped by events that seem impossible until they happen. Why call big surprises black swans? Well, it goes back to the 2nd century Roman poet Juvenal, who said that some events are as rare a bird as a black swan. In reality, black swans aren't so rare, but Europeans once believed there was no such thing because they had never seen one. Their certainty evaporated when early European explorers of Australia came upon swans whose feathers were black. The term has recently come into vogue thanks to Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable, which became a surprise bestseller after the 2008 financial crisis. As defined by Taleb, a black swan is not just an unprecedented event, but one with a large, widespread impact. A small number of black swans, Taleb writes, explain most everything in our world. What are some past examples? Start with the terrorist attack of September 11, 2001. On September 10th, It was all but inconceivable that terrorists armed only with box cutters would use hijacked passenger jets as weapons of mass destruction. The consequences of that unforeseen event include wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, a complete overhaul of airport security, the U.S.'s use of waterboarding and other enhanced interrogation tactics, and the establishment of the prison for suspected terrorists in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Like most black swan events, 9/11 seems entirely predictable in retrospect. Investigations conducted by Congress, security officials, and the press all concluded that U.S. officials could have connected the dots and prevented the 9/11 attacks had they looked at the clues with open minds. Was Japan's earthquake one? An earthquake of magnitude 9.0 fell well outside normal expectations. The largest tremor that earthquake-prone Japan had previously experienced measured 8.5. Nor did nuclear engineers expect that a 40-foot tsunami would overwhelm the seawalls protecting the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear complex and knock out backup power systems. The prospect of both of these events occurring simultaneously seemed extremely remote. Naturally, many commentators have since argued that officials could have planned even for events well beyond the limits of their experience. The Fukushima reactors are facing a scenario that theoretically should have been foreseen at the design stage, said engineering professor Cameron Nickman of Imperial College London, since the plant is built in a known earthquake region. Why can't we foresee these events? Blame it on the way the human mind makes sense of the world. Most human experience falls within a tightly bound range that we call the norm. We tend to focus on that narrow range, preparing only for events we've experienced before. City governments in Boston and Chicago are ready to respond to heavy snowstorms. Those in Dallas and Atlanta are not. Most San Francisco buildings can survive major earthquakes. Most of New York City's could not, even though the city does have fault lines. Our lack of imagination often proves costly. After World War I, for example, the French government built a barrier known as the Maginot Line across the territory the German army had crossed during its invasion. Two decades later, Hitler's army simply went around the Maginot Line, invading from a different direction. Can we predict the next black swan? Surprises are, by definition, unforeseen. You don't get to pick the next disaster, said Craig Fugit, administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Nonetheless, he's paid to think about unexpected catastrophes that could befall the U.S., and there are plenty. A massive solar flare could knock out the entire national electrical grid, including all computer systems, and bring the nation to a screeching halt. A direct hit by a large meteor could kill millions of people and fill the air with enough dirt to block out the sun for months. An eruption of the Yellowstone caldera, essentially a gigantic dormant volcano beneath Wyoming and Idaho, could bury several states in lava and kill millions. Can we prevent such events? Safeguards against some rare occurrences are possible, but most would be prohibitively expensive. A better approach, said Jack Hayes, director of the National Earthquake Hazard Reduction Program, is to develop systems that can bounce back quickly from the shock of a black swan. Think of resilience in terms of the old Timex commercial, he recently told the Washington Post Joel Achenbach. It can take a licking and keep on ticking. He advocates decoupling systems that are critical to society so that the failure of, say, electrical systems doesn't undermine nuclear safety. Nature and evolution already take this approach. Taleb points out that's why we have two lungs, two kidneys, and two eyes. The redundancy provides a fail-safe, Taleb writes, and Mother Nature does not like over-specialization. And the footnote to the briefing this week is called The Black Swan in Your Pocket. Not every black swan is negative, nor are all black swans produced by natural forces. Case in point, the Apple iPod. It wasn't the first digital music player. Such portable devices had become a sizable consumer electronics product category in the late 1990s. But when Apple unveiled the iPod in 2001, it created an entirely new digital infrastructure where users could download new music, update software, get maintenance tips, and share recommendations and gripes. Still, the iPod had many doubters, such as the stock analyst Charles Wolfe, who confidently predicted that the iPod is likely to capture only a small share of the MP3 player market, despite its breakthrough features. As of January 2011, 304 million iPods had been sold worldwide, accounting for 70% of the market for all such devices. The iPod single-handedly transformed the music industry, decimating CD sales and leaving the record companies that depend on them scrambling for a new business model. Today, the music industry is rapidly evolving so that almost all music will be transmitted digitally online from seller to buyer with no physical record. No one imagined that before the iPod. And now, on the Week Magazine reading, let's turn to the best columns in the United States, according to the Week Magazine for April 8th, 2011. The first column for this week is entitled Beware the Coming Cyber Attack by Ken Delanian in the Los Angeles Times. The U.S. is extremely vulnerable to a cyber Pearl Harbor, said Ken Delanian. The country's electrical grid, water systems, gas pipelines, financial systems, and other critical infrastructure are now controlled by computers, and they're so poorly protected from hackers that with a few mouse clicks, terrorists or foreign governments could blow up city blocks, erase bank data, crash planes, and cut power to large sections of the country. One hacker recently hired by a California utility took just a day to defeat the flimsy security on the equipment that chemically treats drinking water. Government officials say China has already laced the U.S. power grid with hidden malware that could be activated with a devastating effect. So what are we going to do about it? Not much. The military now has a group of 1,000 spies and hackers developing protections for its own systems, as well as developing offensive weapons like the computer worm Stuxnet, which sabotaged Iran's nuclear centrifuges. But civilian and industrial systems remain largely unprotected. Former National Intelligence Director Mike McConnell may have it right. The odds are we'll wait for a catastrophic event and then overreact. The next column from this week is Giving Up on the Death Penalty by Donald A. McCartan in the Los Angeles Times. After I sentenced 10 killers to die, they call me the hanging judge, said former California Superior Court Judge Donald A. McCartan. But since I've learned that not one of these murderers has been executed decades later, I've changed my mind about the death penalty. Lengthy appeals, legal errors, and retrials have made a mockery of decisions I once believed promised resolution for the family members of victims, as well as cost the state tens of millions of dollars in court costs. Family members of the murdered, rather than being given fictitious closure by an execution, have been dragged through years of emotional torture as cases bounce around an endless legal maze. In California and many other states, the state penalty is a cruel lie. What victims' families deserve and justice requires is that we swiftly lock up those convicted of murder and throw away the key by imposing a life sentence without the possibility of parole. It's time to stop playing the killing game and wasting money on death penalty cases that are never resolved. Spend it instead on law enforcement, schools, and on the needy. And our third column, The Bible's Endorsement of Violence, Leonard Pitts, Jr. writes in the Miami Herald. People who fear Muslims like to cite passages from the Quran that supposedly prove they want to kill us all, said Leonard Pitts, Jr. The Muslim holy book does indeed contain passages calling for violence against non-believers, but so does the Bible. The Old Testament, for instance, flatly states that if anyone, your very own brother or son or daughter or the wife that you love, introduces you to a false religion, you must certainly put him to death. Moses tells the Israelites to kill all the boys of an enemy tribe and kill every woman who has slept with a man. In Matthew, Jesus warns, "I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." Scholars from both faiths can provide context that helps explain these troubling quotes from a more primitive time. But why is Islam alone held responsible for the violence in its holy book? There are more than 1 billion Muslims in the world, and only a few thousand, far less than 1%, have been involved in terrorism. The demagogues demonizing all Muslims are playing with fire, as we learned during the McCarthy era. Panicked, irrational people are capable of anything. You're listening to The Week magazine from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we turn to The Last Word, another popular feature in the weekly publication that we call The Week. This one is entitled Life in the Year 2100. By the turn of the century, says physicist Michio Kaku, ageless people will think objects into existence. If we could go back to the year 1900, to visit our grandparents, how would they view us? Well, back then, life expectancy hovered around 40 years old. People were largely dirt farmers, and life was short and brutal. Viewing our rockets, jet airplanes, TVs, computers, and internet, they would see us as sorcerers and wizards. But if someone from 2100 could visit us now, how would we view them? Probably like the gods of mythology. They would command everything around them by wishing for it. They would have perfect and ageless bodies, and they would ride across the universe in magical chariots. In the past, we feared the gods of mythology. In the next 100 years, we will become them. Based on interviews with 300 of the world's top scientists, I've put together some predictions for what the world 100 years in the future will look like. This is not a work of science fiction, since prototypes of these inventions already exist, and all of them obey the laws of physics. Just a future of the predictions in my book, Physics of the Future. And they include the following. Number one, the Internet will be in your contact lenses. Imagine blinking and then instantly going online, accessing your home office or home entertainment system anywhere or anytime. We will be able to download any movie, song, website, or piece of information off the Internet directly onto our Internet-enabled contact lenses. These lenses will also be able to identify people's faces, translate their comments, and provide subtitles, so that we will always know exactly with whom we are speaking and what they are saying in any language. We will live in a cross between the Matrix and real life. Tourists will love this, for example, since they will be able to see the glory of the Roman Empire resurrected in their contact lenses as they walk around the ruins of Rome. Artists and architects will love it as well, since they will be able to create great works of art by simply moving their hands in the air. People suffering from illnesses like diabetes will love it too, because they will have immediate readouts of their heart rates, insulin levels, and other important conditions within their own bodies. Number two, computers will disappear, as will cell phones, clocks, watches, and MP3 players. Chips costing less than a penny apiece will be hidden by the millions in the environment. We will be able to command these hidden computers telepathically, directly via the mind. Computers will interpret the electrical signals emitted by our brains, decipher them, and carry out our wishes. When we walk into a room, we will be able to mentally control a computer that in turn will direct the many things around us, moving heavy furniture, rearranging desks, and brewing a cup of coffee, may be possible just by thinking about it. So we will be like gods of mythology, mentally manipulating the world around us. We will also be able to conjure up almost any object just by wishing for it. This will be done via programmable matter, which will consist of millions of microscopic computer chips that will be intelligent and capable of being programmed to suddenly rearrange themselves into any shape or object on command, so that we will be able to create almost anything we can imagine. This is very similar to the replicator from Star Trek, by the way. Number 3, cars will be driverless, using GPS to navigate without the help of an alert human being behind the wheel. These cars will also fly, finally, by floating on a cushion of magnetism. With room temperature superconducting magnets, our cars and trains will glide effortlessly in the air without bumps or potholes to worry about, since the crafts hover above the treacherous road. Traffic jams and accidents will be a thing of the past, as a central computer will be able to track the motions of all cars on the road or in the air, while each car will use radar in its fenders to sense obstacles and take emergency measures as soon as it senses an impending accident. Best of all, we will hardly ever need to fuel up, since there will be almost no friction to slow us down. This will also solve the energy crisis, since most energy is wasted, strangely enough, on overcoming the friction of the road. Number 4, doctors will be able to grow spare parts for our organs as they wear out. This will create a human body shop. We will never need organ donors and will never die of organ failure. Even the typical doctor's visit will change. For a routine checkup, we will talk to a robotic software program that will have a complete record of our genes. This robotic MD will be able to correctly diagnose up to 95% of human ailments. If the robot can't help, then the patient will move on to a living and breathing doctor who can help figure out rarer diseases that take a more refined and sophisticated mind. By mid-century, doctors and scientists may be able to construct an entire organism using its genome alone. As this genome science progresses, researchers may be able to carry a small kit around with them and in mere minutes sequence the entire genome of any life form they encounter. We will then be able to resurrect extinct life forms such as the mammoth, dodo bird, and even the Neanderthal. There are ethical concerns with the Neanderthal. As one scientist asked me, do we put them in a zoo or put them through college? In the movie Jurassic Park, scientists extracted DNA from dinosaurs and inserted it into the eggs of reptiles. Although usable DNA from dinosaurs is yet to be found, there is evidence that in the future this dream might become a reality. That means by the end of this century, our zoos may be populated by creatures that ceased walking the surface of the earth millions of years ago. Number 5, the human lifespan will be extended. Aging will be slowed down by attacking it at the molecular and genetic level. We may be able to cruise at the age of 30 almost indefinitely by growing new organs as they wear out or become diseased, ingesting a cocktail of proteins and enzymes, using gene therapy to alter genes that may slow down due to aging, and following the old adage of maintaining a healthy lifestyle. Genetic engineering will also allow us to create designer children so parents can choose the physical and perhaps even intellectual characteristics of their children. Laws will have to be passed to regulate this powerful technology. Some of these children will be designed to have superhuman abilities or become stronger, more intelligent, and happier than people are now. Item number 6, molecular smart bombs circulating in our blood will home in on, zap, and kill cancer cells. Nanoparticles the size of molecules will seek out cancer cells and destroy them years before they become a problem by either poisoning or rupturing them. We will view chemotherapy as we now view bloodletting and leeches, a painful relic of our ignorant past. Cancer will not be cured. There are too many types of cancers that mutate too quickly, so the disease will persist. However, doctors will be better equipped to diagnose cancer early and treat the disease successfully. Number 7, our toilets and bathroom mirrors will contain DNA sensors capable of detecting proteins emitted from perhaps 100 cancer cells in a cancer colony 10 years before a tumor forms. We will have a complete medical checkup every time we go to the bathroom, which will contain more computer power than a modern hospital. The word tumor will disappear from the English language. Even our clothes will contain these cancer-finding chips, but these chips will also multitask and will be able to independently call for an ambulance in the case of an accident, upload our medical history to nearby hospitals, and sense irregularities in heartbeat, breathing, and brain waves. In the future, it will be difficult to die alone. Today's huge MRI machines that peer into the body will be reduced to the size of cell phones, like the tricorder from Star Trek. When this tricorder is passed over the body, it will immediately detect signs of any illness and project a 3D image of the internal organs for doctors to examine. However, diseases will not be eradicated since they tend to mutate faster than we can cure them and will still do so even in 2100. Number 8. The robot industry will dwarf the size of the current automobile industry. Robots will be everywhere, performing dangerous and tedious tasks. They will have emotions. They will be friendly, polite, helpful, and will fail-safe devices to prevent accidents. Many robots won't be human-shaped, but will be hidden from view, the size of snakes, insects, and spiders, and will undertake various unpleasant and dangerous tasks in place of humans. They will also be used as cooks, surgeons, musicians, pets, store clerks, and so forth. By the end of the century, robots will be nearly as smart as humans and may replace many jobs. Among the worse off will be blue-collar workers who perform repetitive jobs that are easily replaced by robots. Number 9. Tourists will soar into outer space via space elevators. We will push the up button and the elevator will climb a long carbon fiber cable that will extend thousands of miles into space. This will open up the solar system to wealthy tourists and the outer space obsessed. The key is to use nanotechnology to create super strong cables made of carbon. In addition, scientists will be preparing the first starship capable of leaving the solar system and visiting the nearest stars. New propulsion systems, perhaps involving antimatter or fusion engines, will take us there. By the end of the century, we may have a small outpost on Mars, but an overwhelming proportion of the human race will still be on Earth. For decades to centuries to come, space travel will be for astronauts, the wealthy, and maybe a handful of hardy space colonists. And the final prediction, number 10, about life in the year 2100. With advanced technology also will come advanced dangers, especially biological warfare, nuclear proliferation, and global warming. Science is a double-edged sword. One side can cut against poverty, disease, and ignorance, but the other side can cut against people unless it is properly controlled. Global warming will become even more disastrous as rising sea levels inundate many American coastal communities, and some cities, such as New York, take refuge by surrounding themselves with seawalls. Biological terrorists will get more sophisticated and most likely will be able to make viral diseases like AIDS airborne. Since chips and robots will replace a wide variety of products and occupations, millions could lose their jobs, and the economy could be thrown into turmoil. Silicon Valley, for one, may become a dead zone as the chip is replaced by smaller and smaller prototypes, eradicating the area's jobs and upending the nation's economy. And that article was written by Michio Kaku, based on his book, Physics of the Future, and the story originally appeared in the New York Post. Now let's turn to the Health and Science section from the Week magazine for an article entitled Self-Control and Aggression. Dieters beware, choosing an apple over a chocolate bar could leave you itching for a fight. A new University of Texas study suggests that people have a finite ability to exercise self-restraint, and that when it's exceeded, they're resentful, angry, and prone to aggression. Researchers found that people who chose a healthy snack over a tastier one tended to prefer movies with revenge themes over milder flicks. Dieters were also more irritated by marketing messages that used phrases like, "you ought to," because they sounded controlling. And it's not just virtuous food choices that sour a mood. People who showed financial restraint in their choices later showed a decided preference for pictures of angry faces over fearful ones. The results suggest that people have a diminishable supply of energy that the body and mind use to engage in self-control, researcher Kathleen Vose tells USA Today. When people are asked to give up too much at one time, she says, it's natural for them to rebel and fail. And as we get close to the end of our program, we have time for just a couple of quick items here. As a result of safety upgrades, the construction costs of nuclear plants soared 95% after the 1979 accident at Three Mile Island nuclear plant, and the electricity those new plants generated cost 40% more. After the 1986 Chernobyl accident, construction costs jumped another 89%, and the electricity generated by new plants cost another 42%. French adults consume on average less than half the alcohol their forebears did 50 years ago. One reason for the reduction, researchers say, is that the French have moved away from downing a half bottle of cheap table wine at every meal and now have just a glass or two of high-quality wine at dinner or social occasions. The NCAA men's basketball tournament always produces its share of upsets, but this year has been truly unpredictable. Out of the 5.9 million brackets submitted to ESPN.com's Bracket Challenge before the tournament began, only two correctly picked a Final Four of Butler University, University of Connecticut, University of Kentucky, and Virginia Commonwealth University. Election Day no longer is confined to the first Tuesday in November. In the 2010 midterm elections, 27 million Americans cast advance ballots, early voting, 30.5% of the total vote. And now we'll conclude with Poll Watch. 1 year after President Obama signed the new health care bill into law, Americans are still split about its merits. 46% say passage of the reform law was a good thing, and 44% say it was a bad thing, and that's according to a Gallup poll. And 38% of Americans say natural disasters like earthquakes and floods are a sign from God, and 44% say the severity of recent disasters is a sign of the end times. And that was from a survey done by the Religion News Service and the Public Religion Research Institute. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine, April 8th, 2011. Be sure to join me again next time. We really hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.